Don't say.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
And this podcast is brought to you by Audible.com. With over 75,000 books on tape, on audio, on the ability to download instantly, what a great service. Check it out, because not only is it a wonderful service, and I love it, but in addition to that, you can get a free book. We'll talk about that in this podcast as well, but all you're going to have to do is go to audiblepodcast.com/investor. That's audiblepodcast.com/investor. And by GoToMeeting. GoToMeeting is a great sponsor. You know, one of the things that is great about GoToMeeting is that you can have a virtual meeting at any time, and at the same time, you'll be able to just simply share your screen, share the meeting with a lot of people, or just a few, save time, save money, save hassle, and it's just one of those wonderful services that you'll be able to use very easily. It's very secure, and it's very easy to use. So I want you to check it out. You get a free 30 days at gotomeeting.com/podcast. That's gotomeeting.com/podcast. Well, howdy doody. How are you? This is Andrew Horowitz, and you're listening to the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Oh, yeah, we had some fun this week, folks. The week of episode number 164 was up and down, up and down. And I think that's about it. Only 4 days in the week, but it really was up and it was more like down, up, up, down, 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 down that last day. And we saw some pretty shocking numbers when it came to the unemployment numbers. And I think people were really disappointed with that. And on top of that, the news from Hungary and from the Euro. We're going to talk all about that today with my guest, Eve Smith from Naked Capitalism and author of Econ. I think you're going to enjoy the discussion. And we're going to spend some time and get right to her in just a moment. I want to let you know that, of course, you can follow me on Twitter if anybody has any desire to do so. It's at Andrew Horowitz. Love to hear from you as well. Any questions that you may have, if you have any confusion, if you have any things you want to talk about, simply write to askandrew@thedisciplinedinvestor.com. We had lots of questions come in, really. I don't think we're going to have time to kind of cover those today, because I do want to spend some time with Eve with regard to her discussion about what's going on in the world. And some of the questions I have are things like, you know, market transparency, banks, euro, what's happening with the current economics. So we're going to get to her just right away. I also want to mention to you that if you are in a state of confusion and not sure what you want to do, well, that's what we're here for. We're here to answer some questions, but you could also check out The Winning Investor. That's a podcast I do in cooperation and coordination with the Quick and Dirty Tips gang, and that's available. It's a very simplistic kind of look at the markets in terms of a five-minute quickie on what's a PE ratio, what's capitalization, what's value investing. So I encourage you to do that. And of course, if anybody wants to check out the money management service that we have available, if you are confused about these markets, don't know what to do, well, we can help you hopefully with that. And all you have to do is go to thedisciplinedinvestor.com, click on the 14-minute virtual tour. And if ever there was a time to do so, probably it's now, to figure out what is going on and what to do with your money. Because I know a lot of people are getting pretty antsy these days on what's going on with this back and forth motion. Is it time to short? Is it time to long? Is it time to do both? Well, we'll try to help you along with that, and you can see how we do that. But what we're going to do is set up right now and get into a conversation with Eve Smith. And I think that hopefully there's going to be a lot of good discussion about these markets and some great insight into what's going on in the economy and in particular with Europe. Stick around. And welcome back. We're going to be talking with someone who I think you're going to really find very interesting today, because this is a person who has a little bit more knowledge than maybe most when it comes to some of the capital side of the markets, understanding and really not only understanding, but has an in-depth knowledge of the capital markets. Her name is Eve Smith. She is the creator of Naked Capitalism. It's a blog site that just puts a lot of great information, also collects a lot of information from other people that many of us are well aware of and read quite frequently. and she is the author of Econed, and we're going to get into that in a moment. So, Eves, how are you?
Just fine.
So let's talk about some of the things that are going on, and we're going to get to talk about your book, and I also want to talk about the book The Big Short, which I know that you did a little bit of a debunking slash, we won't say ripping, but you kind of took it apart a little bit and talked about some of the possibilities of the depth of the, I don't want to say the truth, but we'll get to that in a second. Let's talk about this, the idea of bank transparency. You and I have talked about this before, the whole idea of, you know, the European zone, and especially, let's say, Spain and Greece. What everybody wants to know is how much bad stuff is on their books. It's kind of like we want to know that in the United States as well. But right now, what everybody's upset about is how much bad debt is on the books there. And one of the problems we have is this whole issue of transparency. You know, are we ever going to get that? And is that something that would even help us understand what's really going on? What do you think?
Well, the real issue with the banks is that part of the reason that the concern with transparency is so high is that they still have loans from the exposures from the crisis of 2007 and 2008 that have not been written off. I mean, for example, Fortis Investment Group at a conference in Boston spoke earlier this week about the fact that they see what they call the great liquidation coming, that only a very small percentage of the bad exposures at the banks, and more important, the shadow banking system, have come off, that the banks are going to be forced to deal with those because the authorities are pressuring them to report those off-balance sheet exposures that they've been able to hide on their balance sheets. And that's going to have a depressing effect on financial assets because, you know, one of the assumptions, even for the bad assets, in their value is their recovery rate. For example, if you're selling a foreclosed house, it makes a big difference whether you get 40 cents on the dollar or 20 cents on the dollar net of all of the, the expenses of liquidating the house. Now, and the same condition exists. So when you've got a big foreclosure inventory, you have depressed housing prices. Similarly, if you've got a big inventory of bad paper that hits the market, that's going to affect valuations. So you've already had that sort of Damocles hanging over the markets. The authorities had done a very good job between lowering interest rates and, frankly, talking up banks in a rather bald-faced way of restoring confidence. And I've heard a lot of people in the industry tell me point blank that they've got paper marked on their books, which is well above its real value on any kind of fundamental basis.
Well, one of the things that happened was that FASB in the United States changed the rules, and they were able to mark up the asset value from a fair value accounting to a mark-to-market or maybe a mark-to-anything they wanted to. Did that not happen in European region?
No, the Europeans have had different rules for how they value assets. They've gone under Basel II rules. Their regulators, if anything, have been more permissive than the U.S. regulators in terms of the treatment of the dodgy assets. I mean, the Europeans are, by all accounts, the European banks are less far through the write-down work-off process than the U.S. banks. So you already had them being perceived to be more vulnerable than the U.S. banks. And now, they've got exposures to the peripheral European countries, both the sovereign debt and to any of the banks that might have, in those countries, that might have bad exposures. For example, they learned, all the discussion about Greece, that remarkably, Greek banks had written credit default swaps on Greek debt. So the Greek banks themselves are doubly exposed. So you've got all kinds of complicated exposures that no one's sure where they run, and markets hate uncertainty.
Markets hate uncertainty. I'm in the throes of reading this book, The Big Short, which we're going to get to in a second, and all of it, especially what I'm up to, talks about the whole CDS exposure. And I wonder, I've been really trying to understand something. We have this sandwich effect where they kind of put on a slice of bread and a CDS and then another slice of bread and a CDS. And it almost seems to me that even if you were really smart and understood this stuff, you wouldn't have done the things that were being done. If you're really dumb and you didn't understand this stuff and did it anyway, I mean, the potential for cataclysmic reaction and the people that were doing this, it's almost like, who was leading these horses to this water?
When you're talking about exposures and the credit default swaps at the banks themselves, the one of the funny things in the run-up to the crisis was all the banks maintained that, gee, we were flat, you know, the point you're making, that they would put on an exposure and then seek to lay it off in the market. The problem was that no one was including the regulators, was terribly inquisitive as to who was ultimately on the other side of these trades. And we now discover that it was undercapitalized bag holders. You know, you had people like AIG, which even despite the size of AIG, you know, we all know now, wasn't even remotely up to being on the other side of these trades. The monolines, which ran with, you know, almost no equity. And then a lot of the other exposures were held by stuffies around the world. You know, they were bundled up in CDOs, but in a lot of cases, the counterparties, you know, ultimately proved not to be good for them. For example, that was one of the triggers of the crisis, was the collapse of one of the early SIVs that a German bank, IKB, had heavy exposures to. So, you know, ultimately, the risk insurance was of such great magnitude that there weren't enough credible counterparties on the other side of these trades.
I got to tell you, I mean, the more I think about CDS and the more I think about the potential that they have, and it is astonishing to me that the regulators don't just clamp down on these instruments, which pretty much are able to be created out of thin air. And in a way, there isn't enough of a pool, as you say. It's kind of like a life insurance pool where they know their potential exposure, unless there's a cataclysmic event that everybody dies all at once. But still, at the same time, there is no requirement to have a level of underlying commitment or regulatory amount that has to be put up as collateral for this at any level. It's pretty spooky that what still goes on today, don't you think?
Yeah, no, I mean, I couldn't agree with you more. I mean, you know, in fact, in Econ, my book, I argue that credit default swaps really don't have, you know, despite people's claims otherwise, they really don't have very much social value. They are primarily, you know, in the old days before they had CDS, institutions were not suffering from liquidity problems in the corporate bond market. If you didn't like a bond, sell it. How hard is that? You know, but it's turned out to be even cheaper for them to put on a credit default swap, even though it is not a perfect hedge. That's one of the things the industry has sort of claimed, and it's really not true. For example, if a company undergoes a reorganization, you know, sells a division, the CDS don't work so tidily across the two. They've got real problems with what happens, you know, either post an acquisition or post a divest. I mean, that was just huge, huge problems with CDS just on a mechanical level. And then to your point, people can just write exposures out of thin air, which is very different from the stock market. You know, there is nothing wrong with shorting when you've got some constraints in terms of how big a short position you can take. But with credit default swaps, you can, and in fact, it's true system-wide, that the short exposures are much greater than the long exposures, much greater. I mean, this creates all kinds of distorted incentives, as well as huge economics risks, as we found it during the crisis.
Right.
You know, it's a product that really should be, frankly, eliminated, but that would be so disruptive to do it in any kind of quick surgical way that you're better off trying to wind them, you know, trying to make them more costly and unattractive to use over time, and regulating them as insurance, which is what they really are, would be much more sensible. I mean, that's a much better way, to your point, of having adequate support behind the contracts. And the contracts, frankly, are not economically attractive if there's adequate capital. I mean, that tells you what a bad product it is. If you adequately provide for capital behind this product, it's unattractive for people to be in this business.
Of course.
I mean, that shows it's a dangerous sham.
Right, of course. Technically, the amount of leverage, that's what really we're talking about, is the amount of leverage that can be used in this and paid off over time when you're the buyer of this, because you pay it off over time. And it's really quite quite to the point of being, you know, it's a gamble, but realize that on the other side, a lot of things can be done. Listen, all the banks that were not allowed to fail, one of the big reasons was because the payoff that had to be made on the CDS exposure to a point, you know, on their debt. So that's a big problem. So let's get back to Europe, though. What does Europe need to do at this point? Because last week we saw the euro crack the 120 into the 119 level, which, I'll be honest with you, I understand that on Friday, for example, there was a big currency expiration that went on, and that could have had something to do with it. The concern was that the bad job number in the United States, you would have thought, would have jumped up the euro a little bit because the dollar should have sagged on that, but it didn't. And the euro is just getting crushed. I mean, there is a big bet against the euro right now. I don't know if there's any other side on the European, you know, with the $1 trillion, that they're even doing their best to buy into the euro to prop it up. There was rumor earlier on Friday that China was buying the euro, which would be good for them because their currency has appreciated about 15% this year in 2010 against the euro, and that's bad because it makes it much more expensive. And about 27% of the trading, the exports that go out from China are to Europe. That's a problem. But Europe has a big problem. The Hungary announcement, I mean, I don't know what went wrong with the, I think it was the chancellor or somebody in Hungary who said that we have a Greek-like crisis potentially here. And that wasn't a smart thing to do in this kind of jittery, you know, jittery market. But what is Europe to do? What is the solution here?
Well, the Europeans do have, one of the reasons the markets are so spooky is that the Europeans, even though they're, there's a good bit of denial there. I mean, I've got a lot of European readers on the blog. And when you talk about the problems facing Europe, a fairly significant percentage of them, and mind you, these are economically savvy readers. This isn't your man in the street, nor is this your average politician. Get very angry as if this is talk by Anglophiles, you know, America, Europe, you know, London talk of people who somehow resent the European project. I kid you not. So there's a level of pointing out. No, I'm not kidding you. So there's a level of, no, you guys just resent the fact that that America's on its way down and the Eurozone could be a successful replacement. And so you get these emotional reactions that, unfortunately, and I suspect that this is true a lot of the politicians, that they see the crit, and, you know, particularly when you've had firms like Goldman behaving so badly in Greece. You know, it's very easy for them to see that, you know, to paint this as some kind of conspiracy and as being an exaggeration of reality when, in fact, the concerns are realistic. The problem that the Eurozone has is that this is going to be, any solution is going to be very messy and political. And it's going to have to go through a lot of steps and a lot of approvals. Well, the markets hate anything that visible and uncertain to begin with. So even if they, you know, pull this one off, it's going to be an ugly process, and the markets will be very, very jittery during it. So, you know, even a good case scenario is going to have a lot of, you know, slips and course changes and nervous making statements that will rattle people. But the bigger problem is that the course that they're going down, even if they succeed, is going to result in a much, 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 much cheaper euro, and that's got the potential to be globally, I mean, as we're seeing, you know, as we saw last week, it's got the potential to be globally destabilizing. The periphery countries have been asked to go through fiscal austerity campaigns. In addition, some of those countries, Spain in particular, have very high, and Ireland, have very high private debt levels. The way the math works is that you can't delever your private sector and your public sector at the same time,
right,
without having a big increase in exports. If you're talking about single countries that could depreciate their currency, this would be no problem. But you're talking about a group of countries when Europe has internal imbalances. I mean, within Europe, Germany is a big exporter to all of those countries. And so you not only have, whereas in Europe, before the euro got weak, was basically in close to trade balance with the rest of the world. So, in fact, the periphery countries' problem is very much a function of internal imbalances in the EU. Now, Germany itself is also launching on an austerity campaign. This is not what you need to fix this problem. You need Germany to be consuming more, and you need the countries that don't have, or excuse me, the countries that have the big private debt overhangs to be given a little bit more slack. Otherwise, you're going to have to undershoot the euro so badly for all those countries to run exports against the rest of the world that you risk massive protectionist reactions.
Right, the
forecast, you know, the markets are basically expecting the euro to get to parity. For them to solve this little problem, without internal rebalancing, the euro is going to have to go between 60 and 80 cents on the dollar.
Yeah, but if that happens, it's going to be an ugly situation because
So basically, it's massively deflationary, right? Because the U.S.'s trade deficit will get worse.
Right.
As you pointed out, China's been buying the euro because they don't want this to happen. It's very bad for China. And any of the other, Japan, which has been in desperate shape for a very long time. I mean, it's just globally very destabilizing. So and there seems to be no willingness to grapple with this internal imbalances issue in the EU.
Well, I got to tell you something. It's funny because in a way you have to look at the U.S. situation here, barring what we saw last week in the jobs number, which was very disappointing, I must tell you. The jobs number that we saw, the NFP number that we saw come out on Friday, there was some good in there. I thought that the earnings uptick was good, although I was personally very surprised at how low the private sector employment was and how far below the entire number missed. Now, I think they were asking.
And you had the usual big birth death adjustment, which people who watch those numbers despise. And you have everybody reading reports going into this expected somehow whatever winks and nods the government officials had given, people were expecting a strong number.
Right.
So it wasn't just that the number wasn't good, that people were expecting a better number.
Right. And Goldman, as a matter of fact, the day before, Goldman had increased their number to 600,000. Goldman has been pretty well right on over the last several months with this, but I'll tell you that the real concern was that, on one hand, you have to look at the real mechanics of how these earnings have been pulled off so well lately, and a lot of it had to do with, we know this, that, cutting of expenses, et cetera. And, I don't think companies are going to be they're not going to be very happy and excited about putting on a lot more people if that's going to cut into their expenses, unless they see a continuation of revenue potential. So there's been a few, clearly more jobs put on than were lost recently, no question about that. And the hourly earnings are up, but and totally strip out the census. Let's just take that out and throw it in the garbage, okay?
Yeah.
But at the same time, you have to wonder, Biden and are they just trying to? It's become so political. It's been so ridiculous. It's been so, that you have to wonder. Are the economics telling the story? Are they leading right now? Because there's so many different reasons why you want to believe at this moment that corporate America, again, just for a moment, ex the European situation for the moment, is actually doing much better. It couldn't do much worse.
Well, the problem is it depends on part of corporate America you're talking about, because jobs, in the last cycle, job growth was driven by small business.
Right.
Even in the last cycle, with big businesses shed jobs. And middle-sized businesses pretty much didn't add jobs, and credit is not available to small companies right now. And small companies are they are less pessimistic than they were as of the end of last year, but they sure aren't optimistic.
Right.
And so many of those, companies. I mean, when we're talking small businesses, we're talking really small businesses. And you're talking about, your local dry cleaner. A lot of those businesses, in particular, are seasonal, and some of them ran off. Many of them are not of a size where they could go to their local bank and get a proper credit line. They run off credit cards or borrowings against real estate. You think any of that's available right now?
Yeah, right. Exactly. It's not at all. So, but what is going to be the outcome? I mean, if we saw such decent earnings numbers over the last several quarters, and analysts, if you've been watching anything about analysts, I mean, analysts have been increasing, upgrading, increasing, only a few downgrades here and there. Is this the end of the rope here? Are we headed down? Because I'm having a hard time, believing that right now, again, excluding this European situation just for one second, on its own. If we include the European situation in right now, and you bring up the fears and you bring up the worries and you bring up all this angst that comes along with it and the hesitation and then the possible write down, or I should say the slowdown in any of the corporate America, who especially the multinationals, have with regard to that, again, aside from any European euro benefit they may get on this, I mean, what is the story with corporate America? Are we, kind of really going backwards here, or are we just kind of slowing down on the next leg up that possibly could restore some, better overall functionality of the markets?
Well, I don't know what you hear from the heartlands, but I perceive there to be a great disparity between what people in New York and Washington feel about the economy and people everywhere else in the country. It's really pronounced. And U.S. is afloat on cheap federal, you know, Fed cash and TARP money. And D.C. is kind of a recession-proof town that has become more and more disconnected from the rest of America. I mean, people I speak to who are in, you know, places like, you know, right now I'm in Birmingham, Alabama. I've been down here watching a trial. And one of the communities here is incredibly affluent. I mean, you wouldn't expect that in Birmingham, but they've got a small suburb that is one of the 10 wealthiest communities in the country. I've never seen so many for sale signs in my life, including lots of ones with new price, meaning the price has, it's been on the market for a while and they've had to cut the price. And that has a big psychological, you know, if the top end in places outside of New York are seeing, you know, visible hits to their wealth that they didn't suffer before, that's going to affect people. And then, you know, in other cities I hear across the country, people in places like Portland, Denver, Chicago, I don't hear people very optimistic there.
No, I don't. You know, people have not been optimistic for a long time. Let's also state the fact that, you know, markets and people's feelings and economies can separate. And, you know, right. What we saw, for example, I have not ever been the biggest fan of Europe. But you know what? There was some opportunities there. And there was some, you know, if nothing else, down from the bottoms or whatever. You know, you want to look at some of those times. You know, I'm getting much more pessimistic. We have a very small exposure to that European region. But it's kind of like, you know, what possibly is going to be the catalyst?
Well, actually, our exposure is much bigger than you think. Over 25% of S&P 500 companies, over 25% of their earnings are actually European earnings, are from European-based operations. Mm. The market is much more vulnerable to Europe than you would think.
Well, I was talking about actually our holdings for our clients, but you know.
I'm saying derivatively,
yeah.
You're more.
I hear you. So
the economies are more integrated than you would think.
So the economy, a lot of the economic numbers that we have been very mixed lately, right? We see some good numbers come out. Manufacturing in some areas have been good. Some have been very light. We see employment numbers being, you know, not good here recently. We see some of the consumer optimism or sentiment coming out good in some areas and bad in others. I mean, there's a very mixed environment right now that should be. We see retail still doing okay, not good or bad, very mixed depending on the area. It's a very mm-hmm. difficult environment, don't you think?
Yeah, no, I mean, it is. I mean, this is one where, the concern I think that a lot of people have is that in both the Great Depression and in Japan's deflation, you had two phases. You had the initial financial shock, and then you had a period where everything looked like, you know, it had stabilized, and, you know, people were optimistic that there was going to be a recovery, and then there was a second leg down. The difference between their cases and what we've seen here is that those periods of stabilization were, you know, in the case of the U.S. was about a year. In the case of Japan was, I think it was 7 or 8 months. You know, we've had a much longer period than that when it looks like the ship was righting itself. And I think a lot of people were optimistic that, gee, maybe all of these, you know, extraordinary measures that the Fed and Treasury had taken really had done the trick. Mm-hmm. But all they may have done, all the better policies may have done is delayed the inevitable, that we're going to have deleveraging, that no matter how you cut and slice it, that's a very ugly process. And, you know, working through that is going to have a real economy impact.
Well, yeah, and the question you have to ask yourself, you have to scratch your head for 1 second, is, you know, do fundamentals matter anymore when we look at a lot of these companies? Because, like I said, things were getting a lot better, and, you know, you have to wonder, with all the information that we do know about the potential of economic slowdowns or economic growth, you know, why are these analysts upgrading like crazy? I mean, we saw a few weeks back that was just extraordinary with upgrades and pricing upgrades on stocks. It was almost like it was, you know, this incredible consolidated and concerted effort by analysts from every different company out there, every different broker was upgrading. I mean, are they just being, are they playing their book, or is there something that we're not seeing? Because it's been a rough ride over the last few weeks for these markets.
Yeah. Well, again, you know, I mean, obviously, the market tends to be pretty punitive when companies miss their quarterlies, which has not been the case historically. So on the one hand, you would think that the analysts must be being fed this, you know, that's why this strategy has worked in the past. The analyst must be being fed this by their clients. I mean, the degree to which that analysts have become scribes for the companies is a bit disconcerting. The flip side is, even if, I go back to the point about job growth, even if a fair percentage of these companies manage to hit their numbers, this amounts to, a lot of it amounts to disinvestment, that they're doing it by cutting marketing budgets.
Right.
They're doing it by cutting staff. They're doing it by things that you know, they've yeah, there's evidence even in the last cycle that they were doing it. I mean, for example, in 2 years of the upturn, you saw 2 years in a row when big corporations were net savers. That is unnatural behavior in an expansion. Companies are supposed to be in an expansion,
mm-hmm.
borrowing to invest in and expand their businesses. If companies aren't willing to invest in their own business, why should you, as an equity investor, be willing to invest in their business?
Yeah, well, what,
I mean, that,
I agree.
That's what is really disconcerting about this pattern. So, you know, it's almost like anorexia. You know, gee, when the model walks down the runway, the clothes hang off it awfully well, but they're unhealthy.
Well, the thing that I've talked about, and I haven't really talked to you about this, so my listeners know about this, is this whole idea that there is a consumption cannibalism going on, where companies have been replacing and expanding infrastructure through technology, through efficiency, a re-engineering, restructuring process. And this is being has led to the lack of a need of employees, and that being the case, when you have less employees needed, but getting the same efficiency out, the same productivity out, and those employees are now out of work, not buying clothes and eating and doing all the things they do. I think that technology, unfortunately, is a double-edged sword. It's excellent for efficiency and for bringing in profitability and for, you know, individuals.
Well, look, except some of that has been to the degradation of the customer experience. Let's go back
yeah,
to, you know, the most mundane example, how everybody hates dealing with call centers from India and having to punch through all these menus to reach a live person. You know, I mean, some of this is not what's, a lot of what is touted as efficiency gains is actually a reduction of customer service.
Right.
And yet they've been able to pass it off as if, oh, everything's, you know, look, for example, I mean, I hate to say I'm old fashioned. I like paper computer manuals, you know. I find I can flip through them faster
and
find what I'm looking for.
Right.
Can you get a paper computer
manual?
No,
you don't want to print those.
You know, software manual? No.
Right.
You know.
Those are like 200 pages. You don't want to print those. But, you know, the other thing is this mass customization that's come to us here, where when I was younger, I don't exactly know how old you are. I'm not going to ask. But let's assume that you're somewhere in my age range. You know, when I was younger, there was a lot more individual restaurants. Forget about the individual hardware stores and stationery stores and all that good stuff, okay, and how those were overpriced. But there was individual restaurants. You went somewhere and you sat down. They may have known who you are or not, but they had their own unique menu, and they would actually serve a fine meal. Now, I'm not saying that the Cheesecake Factory or any of these other places are bad, but they are mass customization, and that's what the next generation is going to get used to. It is a finely tuned and a precision operation when it comes to the food manufacturing, presentation, the training, the everything about the organization is a company rather than a customer experience, in my opinion.
Well, and the other bit is that that particularly when you're talking about something more complicated than a Starbucks, they also have a lot of rigidity. I mean, for example, if you want to introduce something new into the menu, it's an 18-month lead time. I kid you not. You need to test the recipes. You need to train the staff. You need to change the menus. La-di-da-di-da. So now they may have some cycles within those companies where they've built in that, oh, you know, every 6 months we're going to launch new dishes. But, for example, you know, there was one, company that one of my clients was looking at investing in that had a new cooking technology that would have resulted in tremendous cost savings at these companies. They weren't able to implement it because it would require such disruption to their existing businesses. Now, if you had an individual restaurant owner, he could have considered it. But it was like turning a battleship.
Right.
It was amazing how difficult it was for them to implement new equipment.
Right.
For instance.
So let's kind of shift gears for a second, and then I want to get to your book, and I want to talk about the Big Short, the book, The Big Short. Where is the next shock going to come from, in your opinion?
Next shock, we have Europe.
All right, I'm asking the next one beyond that.
I think part of it, I don't think it's separate, I think it's related. Europe is going to expose is going to and is exposing the weakness of the banking system.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Warren Buffett has that expression about how when the tide goes out, you see
all the dirt and the muck.
Yeah. And this is gonna force a recognition of which companies are in not the best shape, or banking and financial institutions.
Right.
The second one is, you know, the second wild card is the is obviously what's happening with the Deepwater Horizon oil spill. You know, a lot of people are saying even if the numbers are as bad as they are, it's really not going to be, you know, the Gulf. You know, the naysayers' argument is that the Gulf is still really big, even though there may be some damage, you know, to the sensitive coastal areas. It's really not going to damage the Gulf that much overall. But you've got the blowback to what this means for deep water drilling,
mm-hmm.
And in particular, one area people haven't much thought about is the impact on natural gas, because there's likely to be restrictions on the use of nat gas facilities that are related to the deep water drilling. So you've got all kinds of potential ripple effects. I mean, deep water drilling in general is the most technologically advanced thing that we do, ex going to the moon.
Right.
And I think, you know, just the safety demands alone on that may have ripple through effects that people haven't really thought through yet. So I think there are other shoes to fall from that that are not yet recognized.
You know, it's interesting because this administration, like them or not, has their hands full. You know?
Yeah. Oh, I know. I mean, this is a complete mess.
Yeah.
And you know, as much as I'm unhappy with the way the Obama administration has conducted itself, you know, the flip side is that it's not clear how many parallel courses of action that they could have had. You know, I think the big thing they could have done is pressure. You know, had they had a better understanding that, you know, they were too reliant early on BP's representations of what was happening on the ground, or excuse me, underwater, more literally, and BP was not giving the straight scoop. And I think they would have, you know, had they known, they would have turned the heat up on BP a lot higher, a lot sooner. You know, and BP itself, even the as you can see from the other names involved, you know, Transocean and Halliburton, you know, they're dependent on subcontractors. You know, are they making the best use of other resources in the industry that they could bring in? I mean, people in that industry regularly subcontract. You know, maybe BP should be pressured to have brought in more resources, you know, from other companies in the business.
I hear you. Okay, so let's talk about The Big Short. And let me mention that, you know, Audible is one of the sponsors of this. This kind of worked out pretty well, I think. Audible is one of the sponsors of this program. Audible has like 75,000 books that are available for you to download. And one of the books that I'm reading right now is The Big Short. Now, it's so easy to use Audible because if you have an iPhone, if you have an MP3 player, if you have a computer, it's really easy. Just simply go to audiblepodcast.com/investor, and you will get a free trial. You get your first book for free, so this is a great opportunity maybe to get this book. I would recommend actually Eve's book, but I don't think it's in Audible format, right?
Honestly, I don't know.
It's, as far as I'm seeing, it's not. It's in Kindle. We'll mm-hmm. we'll make sure to get to that and tell people about that. But The Big Short is available, and it's kind of an interesting conversational type of book that talks about this great opportunity and how it was, I guess, the genesis of the opportunity of shorting through CDS exposure the housing market and bonds. And again, just simply go to audiblepodcast.com/investor. You get this for free. Sign up. Check it out. You're going to love it, really. But tell me something. You know, the story, I'm not going to get the quick down and dirty of what this is all about, and then I want you to tell me your side of this, okay? Basically, and tell me where I'm wrong, too. Basically, yeah. There was a gentleman, his name is Mike Burry, and he was kind of thinking, again, this is an abbreviated version, he was thinking about, wouldn't it be great if I can do something to short this housing market? It looks like it's going to blow up. And through his travels and through his discussions, and he was kind of an awkward guy that really worked alone, he found, hey, we can create something, and he did, and he created these CDS exposures, and it just, let's just kind of fast forward it, it blossomed, and the main person, the main party, was Deutsche Bank, who really grabbed onto this and started to really proliferate this. And it spread and it spread and it spread. And what ended up happening was not only was it used as an insurance product, but it was used as a synthetic mortgage-backed security bond. okay? And it also enabled a lot of companies to bet against individual tranches, as they call it, of the bond exposure in all of these different securitized types of deals that were put together. So it really just expanded to all sorts of layers, and it was just this wonderful, easy thing to do if you would have thought of it, and why didn't more people think about this? And it kind of goes into the discussion about this. Now, tell me where some of this is kind of not maybe laid out as easy as they lay it out in this book.
Well, in fairness to Lewis, he does do, you know, Lewis is a great storyteller, and he does create compelling characters, and he does do a good job of explaining some of the complicated products. The danger of relying on his book as an account of what happened is that he has his whole storytelling style. If you think of all the other books he did, you know, for example, like, you know, Moneyball or The Blind Side.
Right.
You know, he'll take a particular character, you know, and it's always the sort of underdog. It's always the underdog who struggles against, you know, difficulties. And, you know, the classic hero's journey stuff, right? The underdog who struggles and prevails. And he's used to illustrate a wider set of phenomena. Here he uses Michael Burry, but he uses several other characters, including one called Steve Eisman, who had been an analyst in the earlier generation of subprime lending in the 1990s to illustrate this phenomenon. And the problem with this sort of need to make these guys into good guys and heroes is that it leads to a distortion of what really went on. I mean, for example, Lewis keeps going on, and it feeds into, for example, a lot of urban legends that are really dangerous to perpetuate. For example, it perpetuates the who could have knowed, you know, myth of the housing crisis.
Right.
You know, that, oh, nobody saw this coming. These guys are these lonely geniuses who saw it coming, and they made a lot of money. Well, baloney. You know, The Economist had a cover story, June 2005, talking about a global housing bubble. Okay, I mean, this was not a secret. similarly, Lewis paints the story that, oh, you know, everybody in the housing business was a moron and they didn't see it either. Well, in fact, a lot of the people on the investment side, if you went to any real estate conference from 2004 onward, there were panels on the subprime market. People were worried about it and watching it. And one of the perverse things that isn't well understood, which I explain in my book, Econ, is the whole way this subprime shorting strategy worked actually had the effect of suppressing spreads, driving demand to the very worst loans. So the way the shorting strategy worked actually kept the subprime bubble going well past the sell-by date.
Right, because everybody felt more comfortable, right?
The fact that these guys were presented as good guys, you know, they're ones like Burry who really didn't have the vantage to understand the systemic consequences.
Right.
But, you know, Lewis goes through his book, and there's one scene where Eisman, who's the most central character in this, is at a conference, and it's very clear at that point. This is January 2007. It's very clear he understands that the other side of his short is not some other professional investor. It's basically pension funds and idiots.
Right.
Pension funds and widows and orphans. I mean, when I say idiots, I mean chumps.
Right.
You know,
yep,
chumps
yep,
have been sold. And people who shouldn't be in these CDOs. And he walks out of the meeting and says, I want to short everything that this particular guy who's packing these deals does.
Right.
Here he clearly knows the systemic consequences, and he goes pedal to the metal. So I have a problem with presenting these guys as Eisman is presented as a friend of the little guy, not as Wall Street's only socialist.
Hmm.
So I'm very bothered with that this through line completely misses how these collateralized debt obligations distorted the housing market and how the shorts made the problem worse.
Well, what I was troubled with, first of all, there was one thing that I thought was really interesting was a comment that, you know, there were those who didn't know, there were those who knew but really couldn't do anything about it. There was those who knew and wanted to do something about it but really couldn't, you know, and then there were those that wanted to do something but really couldn't because they couldn't stick to their convictions. I mean, that was a lot of people knew.
Convicted their convictions, and the worst is that a lot of people had bad, the part that isn't told enough is a lot of people, is the huge bad incentives. You know, if you're all, money managers are run on one-year time horizons.
Right.
You know, if your peers are doing something that you think is stupid, but if you you're not permitted, for example, you know, if you were supposed to be investing by the mandate of your fund in housing-related paper, and you said, crap, I think this is crazy, I'm going 100% into cash, you would have been punished by the fund managers for style drift.
Right.
You're not supposed to go that heavily into
cash. I agree. It's a crazy thing because, you know, just take the last couple of weeks in these markets from a money manager standpoint, you know, one day up, one day down. And the thing is that, you know, we looked at this and said, okay, if we were short, we'd be no better than if we were long. You follow what I'm saying? You know, it felt better to maybe if you were short, but who would want to be totally short in this environment when we know that it's so easily moved? You know, but in the last 20, 30 minutes of a trading day.
And, oh yeah, no, it's very distressing. I mean, how many days? I mean, it's at the point. I mean, there's some days you can look at at the tape for the day, and there are too many days where it's a negative territory, and you either go into positive territory or much less negative in the last few minutes. I mean, who can trust the market like
and,
that?
And the thing is that there are some good stocks that you want to invest in. There's some great stocks you want to invest in. That will get caught up in the market, you know, noise, of course, you know. And it's a very difficult environment when you have to put up with that noise. You know, it was a lot more fun when there wasn't that noise. But that's another story entirely. Yeah. Let's talk about Econned, ECONNED by Eve Smith. It's available on Amazon. And the undertitle is How Enlightened Self-Interest Undermine Democracy and Corrupt Capitalism. Tell me what that means.
Enlightened self-interest. Basically, one of the key points that the story makes is that, you know, the whole idea of Adam Smith's invisible hand has been very much distorted. Smith, in fact, ironically, Smith wanted to be known not for his work on economics, but for a book he wrote called The Theory of Moral Sentiments. And Smith, even in his Wealth of Nations and his other writings, even though he only mentioned the invisible hand in passing, and he also talked about the fact that, for example, employers colluded to keep wages low, and that European mercantile interests were being very abusive to their colonies in the Americas and Africa. So he talked about the dangers of the abuses of markets as well as the positive benefits of markets. Well, Smith's ideas were cherry-picked and turned into a simplistic ideology in university economics departments. And when you trace through how this economic was dressed up as it really was dressed up as science. In fact, part of the impulse was in the 40s and 50s. The economics profession set out in a very deliberate way to become more mathematical. And that just created a tremendous amount of blind spots, particularly in terms of the assumption to make the kind of math they like to do work, they had to assume equilibrium.
Well, they want to do that. They want to do that for ease, also, so they don't have to think.
No, but that's what I'm saying. the reason they chose the kind of math was for ease. That's what I'm saying. The word they use is tractable, and that's the same reason that in financial economics you have normal distributions, a sort of bell curve, as part of all the models. That's a very practical statistical model. And as a consequence, you've got, of course, Taleb has made that very famous through his book, The Black Swan, but you've got other problems with the kind of models that are conventionally used as investing because they also hide other risks. You know, there are assumptions about correlation and assumptions about market liquidity, which aren't talked about as much. All those three assumptions, the normal distribution assumption, the correlation assumptions, and the market liquidity assumptions, all lead investors to take more risk.
Right.
You've got all the flaws in the model, models pushing people in the same direction.
Well, the other thing is, you know, the other thing that's out there, and you add that to the modern day broker who constantly is dangling hope and opportunity, you know, in front of the investor, and then you put some of those charts and theories behind it, it's a no-brainer. They're being overrun, and there's no way that the investor is going to do anything else but go along with it, like a horse to water.
Exactly. So the result of this was that you know, we had, as a result of this economic series, we had deregulation start in the 1970s. It became much more, you know, became a much bigger wave in the Reagan era, but it actually started in the 1970s. And one of the industries that was most deregulated was financial services. Well, first thing, financial markets have no propensity to equilibrium. Second, ultimately, the financial system is backstopped by the state. But what we've created is, you know, as we see it now in its most blatant form, you know, we have socialized losses and privatized gains. And you look at the book, the Econ describes at some length the structural changes that took place in the industry starting in the 1980s. You saw a change towards much more predatory behavior. It started, and I'm not talking about the abuses in the credit card market, the sort of stuff you'd read about in the paper. I'm talking about what happened in the institutional end of the market here, the part that the portion that hasn't been discussed as actively in the press. You know, that they, you know, before we had, you know, people were not saints on Wall Street. You didn't go to Wall Street to do charitable work. But under the old regime, you had a healthy balance between the predatory, you know, the predatory impulse of the industry. Because let's face it, you need guys who are aggressive. You need people who, it's a transaction-based business. You need incentives for people to have a drive to close. But the flip side is you need checks to make sure that that isn't out of control. You need incentives that give the management layer reasons and tools to curb that kind of behavior. Now, instead, we've removed the incentives, the biggest being the partnership form of organization, for the management group to contain those predatory impulses. You know, we've let them run wild. And the deregulation has allowed tremendous product complexity, which is a great way to hide all kinds of, you know, traps and snares. And, again, you know, you see all kinds of parties who've taken on risks that they didn't understand. I mean, the municipalities are the most extreme example. But, you know, again, you see examples in the all over the institutional end of the market.
The question I guess I have to ask you then is, and this is maybe a setup in a way, but who can we trust?
Well, that's a very good question, because we've also had a 20-year campaign to make people distrust regulators, and we've bred weak regulators for a generation and a half. I mean, you know, most people growing up today, you know, if you're under 45, you probably don't remember a day when regulators were feared.
Right.
You know, so this idea, so you hear, you know, one of the things you read in the press all the time is, oh, the regulators will, you know, will just be fooled, the private sector will just get ahead of them. That's ridiculous.
Right.
You know, all the regulators have to say was what they used to say is, if I don't understand it, it's not happening.
Right.
And that creates an incentive for the industry to have smarter regulators rather, and the government to have smarter regulators rather than dumber regulators. I mean, not the regulators are dumb, but I'm saying, you know, Greenspan basically gave up on understanding derivatives. I mean, he explicitly took in 1996 or 7, I was horrified when I read about an institutional investor. He took this, effectively, let a thousand flowers bloom, posture, oh, anything the industry does is fine. We'll just have the Fed kind of look over their shoulder, and maybe we'll try to migrate the industry to what we think is the best practice, as if the Fed could evaluate best practice.
Right.
You know, I mean, they basically abdicated responsibility. You know, whereas conversely, if the Fed had at that time said, okay, we'll let derivatives happen, but we're going to watch this and make sure our staff understands it, you would have had a lot slower growth, and you would have had, and I don't think it would have been that much slower. You might have kicked out the introduction of some products by a year or two. But the Fed and other regulators would have understood the market as it evolved. You wouldn't have had the industry getting so far ahead of the minders.
Yeah, it's a very, you know, very troubling time. There are some great opportunities we find, and at the same time, the market itself and the way that it's currently structured these days is one that you want to scratch your head sometimes and say, "Hey, what's going on there? You know, is it really you know a situation where you see a 1-2, let's say a 2% up and down on a major market? Do you remember the old days way back when you saw a 2% move on a market? It was like whoa. And when you saw a 1% move on a currency, it was like head for the hills. And now it's an everyday occurrence that you have to get used to and to get the opportunity. And the problem, I guess, comes in, and I agree with you, is that we've all become too used to maybe to risk. But that's not something that's going to die down right now in this environment. Eve Smith, the author of Econ, it is available on Amazon in Kindle edition and in hardcover. We're going to put a link on the show notes and on our website. Also, I encourage you to check out her writings on nakedcapitalism.com. We're going to put that there as well, a link on our website, and have all sorts of information about how you can get there as well there. And boy, lots of great stuff to talk about, and I really do appreciate you coming on today to share that with our listeners.
Terrific. Okay, well, thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
We'll do it again. Thanks so much, Eves. And that's going to wrap it up. Thanks for listening to The Disciplined Investor. And if you have any comments, of course, you can leave a review on iTunes or just send it to me at askandrew@thedisciplinedinvestor.com. I look forward to spending more time with you next week. We have some great guests coming up. Kate Stalter from from Investors Business Daily is going to be showing up. And we have Charles Kirk from The Kirk Report. Fausto Buglisi is going to be on. We have some folks over from Briefing coming on. Lots of good names, and I encourage you to make sure to subscribe through iTunes because that's the way you're going to get it the fastest, or, of course, through Twitter. You could find it the fastest there. Usually they come out midnight on Sunday night, Eastern time. This way we can make sure that our servers are not totally just jammed up and taken out. If you want some more information about how we manage money and what we do and kind of where we put our mouth, words to our mouth, the things that we talk about here, how we actually implement them, of course, that's also at thedisciplinedinvestor.com. And if you want to pick up a copy of my book, it's available at Amazon. I encourage you to do so. A great read on how to understand the markets and how to understand technicals and the quanta funta techna analysis that we utilize. And I think that you'll find the disciplines very interesting. We'll see you next week. Thanks for joining me. This is Andrew Horowitz saying bye-bye for now.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contain forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor regulated by the SEC. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.